forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. I have Deborah Vanal. She's a psychotherapist and a trauma expert. She's also an author. So we're going to talk about her work with people that have schizophrenia, psychotic episodes, things like that, and trauma in general. And we'll talk about her book, and it should be a very interesting call. So welcome. Thank you for coming, Deborah.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, if you would, just tell me a bit about your background and how you came to work with people that have, you know, these issues.
Sure. Schizophrenia was actually my first exposure to mental illness growing up, as I had an uncle who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and he was actually my favorite uncle. I loved him. He was so much fun. That whole side of the family, there were five brothers, and there was just a lot, actually, of symptoms that were delusional amongst them, but one was diagnosed in his early 20s with schizophrenia. And so that was my first exposure to mental illness in a diagnosed clear way as a young child. I don't know that directly led me to psychotherapy. It was probably more circuitous path. I ended up going into psychotherapy to specialize in trauma, which I've been doing for a couple of decades now. And that led to the publication of my books, first Gaslighting, a Step-by-Step Recovery Guide to Deal with Emotional Abuse, and then the Trauma Recovery Workbook for Teens.
Okay, well, there's a lot of different subjects, so let's start with one. So let's talk about gaslighting. In what context are you seeing that in the therapy you do, or and who is doing it? Is it teens? Is it women? Is it men? What's it about?
Yeah, you know, they seem very different, but there are some connections we can discuss. Gaslighting happens pretty much when somebody is trying to change somebody else's perception of the truth to gain control of the dynamic. So that can happen with a partner or with a parent to their child. Sometimes kids might do it to their parent, trying to gain that control as they're working toward adolescence. It can also happen in larger dynamics, like a religious institution or a workplace, where there's a lack of respect for the person and a desire to control and dominate through any means possible. You even see it happening in politics, but that's a whole other conversation. And I think, you know, when it comes to this, you know, just circling back to schizophrenia, you know, one thing I did do discuss briefly in that book is that what we're seeing right now is a lot of people very quickly labeling any disagreement or any challenge to what they say as gaslighting. And it's important to distinguish between when somebody has that intention to control and manipulate and when somebody has a counter view of reality that could be due to mental illness. It could be due to genuine belief that is distorted, not grounded or based in fact. And so I have a whole, is it?
Well, wait a second. So when someone gaslights someone else, I would think it's a known activity. They know that that's not true. Or is it, can gaslighting be subconscious to where they don't even know they're doing it? They're just trying to protect themselves mentally, and so they'll just say anything?
That's a really good question. Yeah, so the person being gaslit is not usually very cognizant of it from the beginning, and hence the need for the book. But because it makes you feel a little bit crazy. But the person gaslighting, you're right, usually that's quite intentional. Usually quite aware that they're doing, although they might not have a name for it, they know that they're making stuff up. And so that's an important distinguishing factor. Are they intentionally distorting the truth? Are they being reactive? And sometimes gaslighting can come into this reactive defensive mode, but there's still an awareness. Whereas when we're talking about this chronic mental illness with schizophrenia, there's not that awareness. And so that's such an important distinction.
Okay, so again, most gaslighters are aware of what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the person who's feeling gaslit, they're feeling like the stories I'm being told aren't making sense. It leaves me feeling kind of off balance, like I don't know what to believe. That's an important distinguishment to make. Is this person intending to manipulate me, or is their grasp on reality a little bit off?
Well, I think that's part of the gaslighting that's embedded in the nature of the term. The person's trying to make you think that their reality is right and yours is not.
Absolutely.
So it's definitely, well, you could say, yeah, premeditated and done with full knowledge of what's happening.
Yeah, I think there's a couple, there's two different levels, really. I talk about different types of gaslighters. You know, there's this really premeditated, sadistic, really kind of control. And sometimes there's more of a reactive pattern of it where the person maybe is motivated by trying to stay out of trouble or to defend their own actions. And so they engage in that, you know, crazy making behavior.
You know, we have a pretty cool resource. And if you, you know, with enough exposure to it, if you develop like the top 10 ways to slap gaslighters back in the face, you know, with just saying just the right thing to stop them dead and get them, poke them. What do you think?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily advise that trying to get into a back and forth with a gaslighter. It's usually better when you recognize that there's a problem to find ways to maintain your boundaries, disengage from the fight because it's not really a winnable fight, and maintain your sanity. So that might be with boundaries within a relationship or even stepping away from it if it's a really toxic dynamic.
Well, what accompanies gaslighting? Is, you know, does narcissism accompany it? Or what other, you know, maybe cognitive distortions or problems gaslighters also display?
Yeah, narcissism is a very common one. Your really chronic, sadistic gaslighters often are classic narcissists. You often see with a lot of the personality disorders. So, you know, you've got your classic narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. Those are those really intentional, cruel gaslighters. And you'll also see it coming from people with more like a borderline personality disorder, where there's that emotional reactivity, and that's where the more defensive style comes in. There's just a lot of volatility in that pattern.
Have you ever seen like two gaslighters like duke it out and try to gaslight each other?
Oh, that's a great question.
That would be a really funny thing to see. It'd be hilarious.
You make a great like SNL skit about that or something. Yeah. I think what would happen is they would disengage pretty quickly because these are people who are looking for power. And so they tend to surround themselves with people that are like, we call them flying monkeys, you know, that support them and hold them up, that'll cover up for them. And so two of these narcissistic domineering type of people are going to not have an interest in the other gaslighter. You know, if they can't get them to fall in line, they're going to push them away in a really callous way and just move on to other people who will lick their boots.
So what does that say about, you know, when someone you know that's in a, you know, maybe they're in a relationship you can't get out of, you know, maybe they're your parent or you're married to them or whatever it is. What do you do to... Can you defend against it without blowing up the relationship, or it's just they're like all in, you know, there's nothing you can do. It's just there's only a nuclear option to stop them.
That's really going to depend on just how deeply entrenched it is. You know, if you've got that narcissistic, sadistic style of gaslighter, your best bet is to really put up boundaries and disengage as soon as possible. You might need to exit the relationship completely or really have very strict boundaries around contact. And there's a difference, too, between being a parent-child relationship and a partner relationship. Partner relationships without kids, without pets, those are simpler, not easy, but simpler. A partner relationship where you share kids, oh man, that gets complicated. You're right. You can't just walk away. So every relationship is really unique in the dynamics. And I actually include a decision tree in my book on trying to figure out how to decide what to do with that relationship. Does it need boundaries? Does it need a cutoff? You know, and if so, what process do we need to go through to make that safe for yourself? And there's a lot of things you can do within a relationship if you are stuck in it to maintain your sanity and your grasp on reality when they're trying to really take it from you. Like taking notes, trying to have a third person present as like a witness to conversations, keeping a journal so that you can check back on the things that you observed so that you can really validate, like, what did my senses tell me, my sight, my vision, and how does that line up with what I'm being told now?
You know, what have you, let's say, counseled some of your patients, say, where they've come back and they're like, oh, it worked. They were so happy it improved.
Often the simplest is the best. So something like, you know, I remember it differently, but in a way that doesn't invite argument, because you don't win those arguments. That person's never going to give in. They can be confronted by all the evidence in the world and just keep doubling down on the crazy lying. And so it's really just best to state your ground. Like, this isn't working on me. I remember it differently. Those facts don't miss. And not go back and forth. End of the conversation.
I'm going to try to tie two things together. I have no clue if they're related. But, you know, from what I've seen firsthand and experienced and observed, you know, people that have various issues, like, let's say, bipolar or, you know, other issues, they have cognitive distortions. You know, like, they're catastrophized, black and white thinking, you know, you hate me, you're mad at me. Or they'll say, you know, that just seem nonsensical. Is that ever confused for gaslighting by people that just don't know?
Yeah, and we're seeing a lot of that. I think you know, just in the last couple of years, since the book was released, the last few years, there's a lot more awareness of gaslighting, which is great because it can be really protective for people who are being abused and starting to wonder, like, well, wait, do I remember that correctly? But at the same time, the rise in understanding has led to kind of an overuse of the word and a misunderstanding of it. So a lot of people will accuse others of gaslighting them anytime that they disagree. And yeah, so you're going to see that.
It was like counterintelligence or something.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, perhaps.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's weird. It's like it's a different way to use it. You cannot even gaslight someone, but you may use it as a defense mechanism, but it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just kidding in the back. It's interesting. Is there a different name for that? Or is that just like, I don't know, retrograde or reverse gaslighting? Like, what would you call that?
I thought about that, but it is kind of like a form of reverse gaslighting, because when the person knows they absolutely are not gaslighting and then it's thrown in their face, it is kind of a form of that. Mind-bending.
Oh man, that's so crazy. Yeah, it is. It just would be funny to have some really clever rebuttal, you know, there to like confuse the person or throw them off. But I guess that has yet to be developed and battle tested, you know? Mm-hmm. So the cognitive distortions that I mentioned, do you see that with patients? And, you know, if so, like, what do you do? How do you, you know, provide therapy, CBT, whatever it is? If someone's in that mode and they seem not to be listening to you, you know, maybe they're even hearing voices that are drowning you out. I don't know.
Yeah, when somebody's hearing voices and those kinds of cognitive problems, the approach isn't actually exactly CBT. It's a little bit a related form called cognitive remediation therapy. So it's really teaching skills, like when we're talking about schizophrenics specifically and people with delusional disorder, things like that. It's teaching thinking skills, that learning how to analyze your own thoughts, you know, looking for the evidence rather than just leaning into it. You know, I've had a patient, for example, who was telling these horrible stories of trauma. And that's the thing, is I specialize in trauma. So and this gaslighting piece, I don't want to gaslight my clients by saying, you know, those classic phrases of like, you're making it up, but something's not feeling right. You're telling me this horrible story of trauma. And of course, I usually believe my clients, and this gut sense is saying, something's off here. And so you start asking questions like, how did you come to remember this previously buried trauma? Well, my spirit guides told me. Okay, that's new information. That's not consistent with any kind of religious history or anything like a native belief system or anything that wasn't part of the cultural picture here. So So we're getting something from spirit guides. Okay, well, let's explore that further. What are your emotions when you remember this? Oh, I don't really feel anything. It's just information. Okay, that's a red flag. That's not really usually congruent with trauma unless there's dissociation happening. But you start to kind of explore that. Well, let's look for how that matches up with evidence. Okay, like, and I'm trying to do this in a really gentle way because we don't want to, again, accuse somebody of lying. Or, and you certainly don't want to tell them I don't believe them if perhaps there's a possibility that it's true. But, you know, you start to look at the other evidence like time and place. And, you know, if suddenly you've got this new information that you were kidnapped from the age of 15 to 16, and yet you're also enrolled in high school in this city at the same time, you know, things don't match up. And so that's where we get to trying to teach those thinking skills, that cognitive remediation, to really analyze it for themselves so that they can test the spirits, test the things that are coming to them, or if it's visual, test those hallucinations against other evidence. It's really challenging.
Well, how do people react to that when you start to push on against their irrational bubble, I guess you can call it, or whatever you want to call it, their worldview? How do people react? How do you do it where you don't freak them out?
Yeah, you have to go quite slowly and be very sensitive, very gentle, because it can be jarring to suddenly realize, wait, something doesn't feel right. And a very human, and this is not about any mental illness, but a very human reaction we have is we hate cognitive dissonance. So we'll do anything to resolve it, right? So if something feels off, we want to either double down or we don't usually like to shift our beliefs. And we can see that throughout society, right? You get a fight, get in a fight with somebody on Facebook, people aren't like, oh yeah, okay, good point. You know, I see your point. Usually there's a doubling down. And so we have to be really slow and gentle, just, you know, asking questions with curiosity. Oh, maybe, or maybe just look into that. Yeah, might be good to ask about that.
But what do you mean? What happens when you do that? Does the person double down, or do they just, are they confused? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, there can be some confusion. The thing that's tricky with a condition like schizophrenia is most of the time, patients don't have awareness of it. And so it's really important to get to the point in treatment where they can recognize it or recognize that they have this condition. And then this kind of skill training can really come in handy where they're willing to buy into the process. But unfortunately, that doesn't often happen until there's been some kind of a crisis leading to a hospitalization or something like that.
So in schizophrenia, yeah, I've heard that 50 to 75% of people that have it don't think they have it. It seems to make it incredibly hard to deal with if that's the case. Like, what do you do if one of the people you're trying to counsel is like that?
Well, you know, it's not an area that I specialize in. And so, like I said, I have people who present with schizophrenia coming through due to a belief that there's trauma or something like that. So that they don't necessarily tend to be long-term clients of mine because I want to connect them to somebody who is going to be able to provide that long-term intensive services with medication management piece as well. So yeah, I mean, sometimes that ends up being referral or there's a hospitalization crisis that alters the course of treatment.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, you also mentioned that you deal with your trauma. So let's, you know, if that's not your focus, that's fine. Let's shift to trauma. What does that look like in your practice? Do you deal with people that have childhood trauma or, you know, other kinds? Like, what are some common ones you deal with and how do they affect people?
Yeah, I deal with quite a wide range of traumas, childhood abuse, rape, and sexual assault. I've had a lot of people who've lived through mass shootings and other kinds of violence, domestic violence. Yeah, and so despite the wide variety of circumstances that cause traumatic symptoms, there's really, there's a lot of similarity in how that affects the person, as well as how we approach treatment. You know, the other tie-in that I wanted to mention too on the topic of schizophrenia, because I know that's a question of interest today, is that we're discovering in the research more and more just in the last several years, in the last decade, that there really is a tie-in between. So I was talking about examples where somebody, you know, has perhaps had a delusional new memory of false trauma, but there's actually a big tie-in between a history of trauma and later development of schizophrenia. So it's so important that we provide effective trauma therapy as soon as possible too. I mean, schizophrenia isn't simply a result of trauma. I don't want to give that misconception. It's a result of kind of the Venn diagram of genetics, brain chemicals, and environment. And that environment piece very often involves childhood trauma. So yeah, circling back to the trauma side, you know, effective treatments, it depends a little bit on the age to some degree. You know, a child who's experienced some trauma can often benefit from something like play therapy, where you've got a very metaphorical way of working through it. Art therapy can be very powerful. EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and brain spotting, which are connected therapies, really, really powerful modalities that I work with to help people of all ages work through past traumas as well. And there's somatic therapy, which really gets into the body where the trauma is stored to release it from there.
What is brain spotting? Is that like, you know, in my head, I thought of train spotting, but I know it's not that, but what is it?
Train spotting, I love that. Yeah, brain spotting grew out of EMDR. So people are a little bit more familiar with that lately because it's been around for about 45 years since the 80s. Brain spotting's only about 20 years old. So to explain brain spotting, let me start with EMDR, which again, it stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And that comes from the understanding that the bilateral movement, usually the saccadic eye movement from side to side, stimulates the left and right brain and really helps to process, just like in REM sleep, where your eyes are moving back and forth, you're processing the stresses of the day. But with a trauma, it's so overwhelming to get stuck and your dreams aren't enough to resolve it. So be kind of facilitating that in the waking movement through EMDR. When about 20 years ago, an EMDR therapist was working with somebody and just noticed that patient's eyes kept kind of getting stuck, sort of like wanting to stay in one position. And so in the spirit of exploration, he's just like, let's just stop there. And he held his fingers, you can often use your fingers to move back and forth, at that one spot. And as he did so, they found that this whole wealth of information came pouring out that hadn't really been tapped into before, that connected back to the original target they were working on and created an absolute breakthrough. And so that developed the theory that like every spot in our visual field is a neurological tie-in to different, or we store our memories in these different spots in our visual fields. And so through helping the patient find the right spot, left to right, up and down, near and far, the right spot in time or in space, and gazing at that, and then adding in the bilateral movement that stimulates the brain that way through headphones, through music, we're able to really process trauma. And I found with my own patients who I've done both with, that most tend to really like the brain spotting because it feels somehow a bit gentler. I don't know another way to explain it. It just doesn't feel quite as jarring somehow. So, but it's really, really effective.
But again, what would you do in an EMDR situation, using your finger and they're tracking it? It's kind of like, I guess, being pulled over for DUI. You know, they do the field sobriety test. They do the horizontal gaze and the stagmus, see if your eyes jump, you know, with the pen back and forth. Is EMDR similar to that? And why is it more jarring, you think, than brain spotting?
Yeah, somewhat similar. So it's continuous back and forth from left to right. You want to move it far enough that your eyes are going basically to the corner of your eye and on each side without moving the head. So just the eyes are moving. We have light bars we can use, or the therapist might move their fingers or a pointer back and forth. And there's also sometimes for people where, you know, visual isn't the approach, we've got tactile little buzzers they can hold in each hand with a buzz going from side to side, and even the auditory part. So there's different ways we can tap into that bilateral movement. I'm not exactly sure why it feels less jarring. Perhaps because you're able to stay where your brain wants to go rather than moving on and off of it in the visual space. And it has just a bit of a more free-flowing, organic setup than EMDR does as far as the assessment and setup process goes.
Okay.
I practice both. Both are very, very effective. So that's just my clinical experience with the two.
Well, how do you choose then what to do? Do you do EMDR? Does it work better? And if the person's like, oh, then too much, or if you determine it's like too intense and you back it off?
I often give them choice, or, you know, for somebody who's more anxious, they may prefer EMDR because of the more structure to it can kind of fit better with that personality. And they're not, with brain spotting, it's a little bit more open. And so they might, there's often a question of like, am I doing it right? And they can get in their own way that way. Yeah, so sometimes we'll do this the session and try that the next session. Sometimes EMDR takes longer to set up, and so time might even be a factor. And then just kind of let them choose what seemed to work better for you. Not everybody's the same, and so not every treatment should be the same either.
Well, how can they choose if they don't experience it?
Well, they will. You know, if they would like to try 1 week and another one another week, you know, and then, you know, going forward, like, what do you want to do this week?
What? Oh, okay. So what do they tell you? Like, oh, that was too much, or what feedback do you get?
You know, usually just like, oh, let's try this one. You know, let's go back to that one. I liked that, or that seemed to work better for me.
Oh, but so they're not giving you details on what the experience was like? Has it just seemed to you like, oh, there was too much for this person, let's back it off? Or how do you make this determination?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, there's, you know, I do we call a subjective rating scale at the kind of like a pain scale you might get at the doctor's office at the beginning and the end. And sometimes even at a midpoint, you know, how much distress are they feeling about the target memory? And so what often happens is that distress level will increase as they're processing and then decrease to a level lower than when they started. So they might say like, oh, this is like an 8 out of 10. And at the end, like, this is like a 2. Okay, that's good improvement. So that's one way that we assess how it's going. Something that feels like it started at a 9 and now it's like off the scale and that's just too intense, I can't stay with it. There's adjustments we make. And it's not just necessarily one or the other, because there's different adjustments within each modality that we can make to treat the intensity. I think it's just a very subjective experience.
Okay. So when you're doing the EMDR, for instance, are you watching their eyes?
Yeah.
To see if they, do they have like, you know, again, the police look for a nystagmus where the eye will jump as it goes, you know, let's say to the left, 30, 40 degrees to the right. What are you looking for? And what does it tell you?
There's so many micro expressions that people express without any awareness. And so I'm carefully watching the patient, you know, the eyebrows go up, the eyes widen just a little bit, the pupils dilate, the breathing changes just a bit more deep and loose or rapid and shallow. And so I'm watching for those cues. And sometimes there's a sense like you can tell through all these micro movements that they're really in the traumatic memory, and it's not a good time to stop them because they're just very subcortical, very in that emotional part of the brain. And then there's a sense of really perhaps a little relaxation or something shifts. And then I might stop the movements or just check in with them. What's going on for you now? What are you noticing? What are you feeling? And there may be a little reframe or just a, okay, good. Good check, you know, and then we just continue on with another set or another period of time.
So you're not watching for anything, or are you watching, again, their eyes, but what their eyes do doesn't matter. It's what they tell you, or like, how are you evaluating what, how to guide this experience?
Yeah, you're definitely watching the eyes. You're watching all the little tiny muscles in and around the eyes, around the mouth, around, you know, in the chest, the way that they're moving their body, like jiggling the foot, like every little thing, really very, very tuned into what's going on there and what it's signaling, and responding accordingly. And then checking in as well verbally from time to time.
Yeah, all right, I got it.
You can really get out of the way, because what happens with talk therapy so often is we're talking about the trauma. But the thing is with trauma is it's not stored in the prefrontal cortex where we process language in a logical place. It's stored in the limbic system, in that emotional center, especially with the amygdala, the fight or flight or freeze. And so if we just talk about it, we're actually kind of taking them out of the part of the brain where the trauma is stored, where they need to process. And so we're really utilizing a lot of silence in the process so that they can go back, make these connections as we're activating all the parts of the brain, allowing them to connect the logical with the emotional, which kind of soothes it, and that moves toward resolution. And then we will usually finish with talking about the experience as well and what came up for them. And so it's really okay. Watch as they go through it and the little things they share, and I'll take notes how, you know, the cognitive distortions that might be at the beginning start to shift, and organically, without my telling them, they're starting to come to new realizations. So for example, somebody might start with like, it's all my fault, I feel dirty, you know, and in the end, they're starting to realize like, wait a minute, you know, I only came up to counter height. How was this my fault? How was I in charge? I was little. Oh, that's interesting. Notice that. Let's keep going, you know, and then it's like, wow, I feel a sense of relief. And then, you know, okay, well, now anger is coming up. Okay, go with that. Let's let yourself feel that. See what happens. And then maybe a thought comes up to them later, like, you know what? That person was just like a pathetic person. They're not worth my emotion. Okay, notice that. And then the emotion subsides as well. Like, this is an example of a pattern that I often see. I don't want to oversimplify because we're talking about this is happening over a period of time, but not in the 1 minute example, but it's amazing. It's amazing what happens when we kind of get out of the way and just facilitate the process. The brain wants to heal just as much as the body does.
Are there particular types of traumas that are more amenable to EMDR, the ones that it just doesn't work for?
I wouldn't say there's any it doesn't work for, but I would definitely say there is forms of therapy or forms of trauma for which it'll work more rapidly. So a simple incident, acute trauma, I can see some amazing rapid transformations. So somebody who had a traumatic stillbirth or something like that of their child, somebody who was sexually assaulted, somebody who was in a car accident and watched somebody die. These things that happened on a single day without a background of chronic abuse are often resolved really rapidly. Chronic child abuse moves a lot slower, but I would not say it is ineffective. It does take time to really build trust, to build a sense of safety, to help the person become in touch with their feelings, because often they're very dissociated from their emotions because it wasn't safe to feel, to come back in contact with their body if they've learned to dissociate from their body because it wasn't a safe place to be. And so the process...
What does that mean, dissociate? I don't understand. What do you mean? How do you dissociate from a feeling?
Dissociation is often felt like a floaty feeling, feeling kind of like you're not in your body. You're hard to feel your emotions. It's a sense of disconnect from self. What often happens, a classic example would be, say there's a child who's being abused, and in that moment, it's so overwhelming, they can't process the experience. And so they actually learn to split off from themselves and imagine that they're watching the experience, not being in it or going somewhere else in their mind. When there's repeated and chronic trauma, that can lead to that process happening automatically, where they're often feeling dissociated or separate from themselves. And you can imagine that going through life like that is really, really difficult because you're not fully present.
What does that mean? You'll act maybe inappropriately, or you won't express the requisite emotion in a scenario that other people would?
That's possible, but also you're missing out on a lot. You're not able to fully feel joy, and you're also having a difficult processing painful emotions because you don't know how to handle them. So they tend to just be split off. But what's split off isn't gone. It's just kind of stuffed down. And so people may engage in other processes to deal with what's kind of split off, like emotional eating, for example, or other addictive behaviors.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book. What's the title and what was the main focus of it?
So I have two books out so far. The first one is Gaslighting, a step-by-step recovery guide to deal with emotional abuse and build healthy relationships. And the second book is Trauma Recovery Workbook for Teens. So gaslighting breaks down what gaslighting is, helps us understand the profile of a gaslighter and the techniques and tools they use to control somebody and emotional abuse in general and its effects. And the second part of the book goes through seven steps to healing from that kind of emotional abuse, from understanding and accepting that it's happening, that this relationship maybe isn't all that you'd hoped it would be, understanding the cycle that you're engaged in with this person, letting yourself grieve what you hoped it might have been, and then turning inward to really begin healing, learning to love yourself and prioritize yourself when that wasn't given to you, learning how to build healthy boundaries, which is so important when that's been systematically taken from you, making decisions about the relationship with the gaslighter as far as, you know, staying in a relationship or not, or what that might involve. And then guidance on developing healthy relationships, perhaps with other people, so that the cycle is broken. Because what we often find is that somebody who maybe grew up with that kind of abusive gaslighting ends up in relationships later in life that repeat that cycle. And so we want to really break that cycle for good.
What about the trauma network? The trauma book for teens, the workbook for teens?
Yeah. So this is a handbook that I hope that teens can use on their own or as an adjunct to therapy. It really explains what trauma is and isn't, you know, fact versus fiction, types of trauma, how it impacts you. Then it moves into addressing your trauma, accepting that what happened to you is not your fault, understanding your emotional reaction to it, learning how to manage those emotions, and even embracing some of the emotions that we have. Then we move into looking at how to take back control, because that's a big thing that's often stripped away in a traumatic situation, whether that's from abuse or assault or something out of control that happened, like an accident. What makes something traumatic often is that loss of control that accompanies the bad thing. We talk about developing resiliency so that we're looking ahead, not beyond just healing, but resiliency against the future things that could happen in life. Navigating social dynamics in that trauma really impacts us socially. And so we want to look at how to rebuild that aspect of life. And then finally, a focus on the future, how to move on from trauma and embrace a healthy future for yourself.
So what kind of feedback have you gotten from the trauma workbook? Anything that surprised you?
It's just heartwarming to me. You know, I read every review and I love to hear how it's impacting people. Like just the other day, I saw one where a mom wrote in and she said, "This gave me my daughter back." You know, she was, after the horrible thing happened to her, she was starting to use drugs. She was angry all the time. And now she's laughing and we're having deep discussions. And, you know, you've gave me my daughter back. And that's the kind of stuff that just, it brings tears to my eyes, really, because that's why I write, you know, and to make this accessible for people who maybe don't have access to quality therapy due to cost or location. Or waiting lists.
Yeah, from what I've heard, there's a big shortage of therapists, and you know the way everyone seems to be anxious and having all these mental problems. I think the shortage is going to get far worse, unfortunately. So resources like you've created are really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like the importance to me in writing this one for teens specifically. So often, what we deal with, I have somebody coming in, they're 30, 40 years old. They're often talking about things that happened in their teen years. It's a tricky, volatile time. But when things are left for a really long time, it can really develop into secondary problems and really take a root into your psyche. So I'm really passionate about this reaching teens shortly after whatever it is that they've unfortunately gone through, so it doesn't lead to those secondary mental health problems.
What do you mean? Like what kind of secondary problems?
It can be a range of things, personality disorders or really entrenched anxiety or depression. Even, you know, we talked about the tie into schizophrenia. There's really a whole range of mental health issues that can come from trauma, in addition to the classic, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. But the thing is, when you're a teenager, your brain is, we say neuroplastic, in that it's rapidly forming new neural connections. It's changing, it's growing. And at the end of adolescence, it's a lot less malleable. There's always room for change, but the capacity for change is amazing in the teen years. And so if you haven't spent decades struggling with anxiety and depression, it's much, much easier to ameliorate.
I see what you mean. Well, very good. So people can get both of your books, or you know, either one, if they've got a problem with a gaslighter, they know that would be a good one. And if, again, they have a teen, or they are a teen, the workbook would help them, which is fantastic. Do you do in-clinic therapy? And if so, like where do you help people?
Yeah, I serve California residents both online and in my office in Southern California in Upland. You can find me at drdeborahvanal.com. Links to my books, links to my therapy site.
Well, very good. Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.